Okay, so we backtracked to chapter 12, and we finished that, wrapped that up, and so we're back into the 15th chapter, Practices and Perspectives, number 3, and that's where I kind of talked about the emptiness or dwelling in voidness, perfect composure developed along the path, and then it was sort of in brackets, see chapters 12. So I went back and did that, but also making the statement are thus also fruits of the practice. Although these qualities may seem to resemble aloofness or coldness, the opposite is true. And I think that's somehow that tendency to think in terms of dwelling in emptiness or voidness, and you're just sort of vacant or non-responsive to the world around one, non-engaged in the world around one. The Buddha drew countless beings to his presence because of his inspiring demeanor. Throughout the history of Buddhist countries, enlightened followers of the Buddha have always been a source of encouragement, and the many folk have wanted to draw close to them because of the warmth of their example. Indeed, the Buddha praises those who live for the well-being of others. And this is a sutta from Anguttara. And what I did is amalgamate two suttas, actually, from the Anguttara 4's, sutta number 96 and sutta number 99, sort of mushed them together a bit to carry the themes. These four kinds of persons, O monks, are found existing in the world. What for? There is one who lives for his own good, but not for the good of others. One who lives for the good of others, but not for his own good. One who lives neither for his own good nor for the good of others, and one who lives for both his own good and for the good of others. And how, monks, does a person live for his own good and not for the good of others? He practices for the removal of lust, hatred, and delusion in himself, but does not encourage others in the removal of lust, hatred, and delusion. And then skips to 99. He himself abstains from killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, false speech, and the intoxicants, but he does not encourage others in such restraint. And how, monks, is a person, how, and how, monks, does a person live for the good of others, but not for his own good? He encourages others in the removal of lust, hatred, and delusion, but he himself does not practice for their removal. And then from Sutta 99, he encourages others in abstention from killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, false speech, and intoxicants, but he himself does not practice such restraint. And how, monks, does a person live neither for his own good nor for the good of others? He neither practices for the removal of lust, hatred, and delusion himself, nor does he encourage others to do so. He neither practices abstention from killing and so forth himself, nor does he encourage others in such restraint. And how, monks, does a person live for both his own good and for the good of others? He himself practices for the removal of lust, hatred, and delusion, and also encourages others to do so. And he himself practices abstention from killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, false speech, and intoxicants, and also encourages others in such restraint. In this way, the practice aimed at the attainment of Nibbana can be an act of compassion, both for ourselves and for those who are inspired by our example to undertake the practice for themselves. And I wrap up the chapter from Samyutta 43, Sutta number 1. Thus, bhikkhus, I have taught you the unconditioned and the path leading to the unconditioned. Whatever should be done, bhikkhus, by a compassionate teacher, out of compassion for his disciples, desiring their welfare, that I have done for you. These are the feet of trees, bhikkhus. These are empty huts. Meditate, bhikkhus. Do not be negligent, lest you regret it later. This is our instruction to you. Any questions, comments? I'm very quiet today.
I've got a comment.
Yes?
But I don't know if I took it all in enough with this comment, so just dismiss it if it's not relevant.
Yeah.
But it just sort of, the gist of it all seemed to be about refraining from, and that
yes.
The way to really benefit yourself and others
yes.
is to not do.
Yes.
And not do.
Yes.
And I think that when you hear it, it feels quite negative.
Well, that's why I started off in that sense of the, because you know, even in the sense of because we spent a lot of time talking about emptiness and sunyata, and that can be easily seen as a negation. But the reality is that, say the presence or the demeanor or the affect for the result of that is tremendous compassion and it draws people. I mean, you think of the Buddha himself as an example, just drew countless beings to him and inspired them. Think of present day teachers. And similarly, and one of the reasons, I mean, it's a a particular way of approach in terms of how to because there are things that you can refrain from, but you can't mandate how wise or compassionate or kind somebody is. You can, of course, the encouragement is always there, but you, as a bottom line, you can't mandate it. You can encourage, which is done. But then once you've put that into a statement, then you've got it's hard to quantify, and people tie themselves in knots, trying to be compassionate or trying to be good, but then how do you? Where is the end point of that? Well, the bottom line is, if you can just keep a bottom line. The relinquishing of greed, hatred, delusion. Oh, the refraining from the fundamental things that harm others. That's a good indication. Am I on track? Because there's lots of religious teachings and religious teachers who preach about compassion and then you do some pretty nasty stuff. So I don't think, certainly also another aspect is of course the different teachings are sometimes have a different context. Like one of the things that comes to mind is the teaching that the Buddha gave, you know, do not look down on merit. This is another word for happiness. So that sense, so the Buddha But again, you can't mandate how much merit, or you can't just even to sometimes describe how much merit. But you can encourage. Yeah, don't look down on merit. This is another word for happiness. Or the Buddha was talking about, yeah, anybody who has your limbs are being sawed off by bandits or the two-handed saws, and you have the thought of anger and ill will, you're not quite practicing loving kindness to the degree that you should be. Okay. Okay, we'll go on to chapter 16, which is the title of that chapter, Solotapanna, Spiritual Turning Point. And this is four chapters on Solotapanna. So this is one. And I begin the chapter with, and this is from Samyutta 56, which is that's the last chapter of the Samyutta Nikaya, and is on the, it's the Satcha Samyutta, the chapter on the Four Noble Truths. So entering the stream. Bhikkhus, suppose there were a man with a lifespan of 100 years who could live 100 years. Someone would say to him, come, good man, in the morning they will strike you with 100 spears. At noon they will strike you with 100 spears. In the evening they will strike you with 100 spears. And you, good man, being struck day after day by 300 spears, will have a lifespan of 100 years, will live 100 years, and then, after 100 years have passed, you will make the breakthrough to the Four Noble Truths, to which you had not broken through earlier. It is fitting, bhikkhus, for a clansman intent on his good to accept the offer. For what reason? Because this samsara is without discoverable beginning. A first point cannot be discerned. A blows by spears, blows by swords, blows by axes. And even though this may be so, bhikkhus, I do not say that the breakthrough to the Four Noble Truths is accompanied by suffering or displeasure. Rather, the breakthrough to the Four Noble Truths is accompanied only by happiness and joy. So that's a pretty tough sutta. But they are stark in the sense of, this is how important this insight into the Four Noble Truths is. And breakthrough to the Four Noble Truths is one of the ways of describing the entering of the stream, the Sotapatti. The importance that the Buddha gives, because as long as one has still not entered the stream, then one keeps wandering in samsara, wandering entangled in greed, hatred, delusion, wandering in suffering, and it's hard to discern where that's gonna end up, other than more suffering. But so yeah, if somebody were able to make a deal with you to, be struck by these spears and in the morning and in the daytime at night and then it would guarantee your penetration of the Four Noble Truths, that would still be a good bet. So it just is. They say the hyperbole of the heightening of that situation is important to sort of say, yeah, this is really important, and what we're doing is really important to be practicing to in order to understand the Dhamma, enter the stream of the Dhamma. Yes.
I've often felt like I've made this deal.
Right, it feels like, sometimes it feels like that in practice. Yeah.
The spheres that come your way, and it feels like 300.
Yeah, and it's important that it's, because, we all do it. And we do experience suffering, and we manage to, and much of it is us stabbing ourselves. But I think it's important to also, to be whatever suffering, difficulty, obstacle that one is experiencing, that it really is brought in to the inner heart, that open aiko dhammo, that leading it inward so that it's a catalyst for change, rather than, oh, woe is me, I've stabbed myself with another spear. I've always do this. Just being able to, really using it as a catalyst and a motivation to free the heart. Okay. So that's how I start in the chat. I figured I'd try to get people's attention starting the chapter. It would be useful now to direct our attention to the fruits of the training. The above image vividly displays the urgent necessity of realizing the Dhamma. The quote-unquote breakthrough to the Four Noble Truths is usually equated with the entering of the stream of Dhamma, Sotapatti. And and I go to a quote from the Mahavagga, from the Vinaya, and is a description of the first, actually the first layperson who paid respects to the Buddha at the Deer Park at Isipatana, during the time that the Buddha had spent that rains retreat with the first five bhikkhus. When he saw that Yasa's mind was ready, receptive, free from hindrance, eager and trustful, he expounded to him the teaching peculiar to the Buddhas: suffering, its origin, its cessation, and the path leading to its cessation. Just as a clean cloth with all marks removed would take dye evenly, so too, while Yasa sat there, the spotless, immaculate vision of the Dhamma arose in him. All that is subject to rising is subject to cessation. So, of course, that's that we chant in the Dhamma Chakra. Insight into impermanence and uncertainty is forms a key part of the insight into Dhamma. Also, this, I was just thinking that what I didn't include in this is actually the, because this is like a stock phrase of what happens, and usually the Buddha, when he, what is it called again? There's a graduated teaching on the on the Dhamma, that he introduces people, and it's, and again, it's a stock phrase, and it's introducing the sort of, and the benefits of generosity and the benefits of virtue, on the benefits of the kind of all the fruits of say, of the heavenly realms, of the dangers in the world, about renunciation, and then when he saw that, he sees that someone's mind is ready and receptive, free from hindrance, eager and trustful, then he would teach the Four Noble Truths. So he usually didn't. You just hit people with the Four Noble Truths, and they would get awakened. It would, there would be a preparatory base or foundation that that person would need to establish in order for the Buddha to give those teachings, and you know, preparing the brightness of the mind and clarity of the mind, so that it's bright, it's still, and then the Buddha speaks on the nature of the Four Noble Truths. Yeah.
Is it possible to repeat the preparatory stage?
It's possible. If I had a memory like Ajahn Amaro, I could just sort of rattle it off like that. No problem. But I rely on an iPhone. What am I? And I can't even remember, there's
gradual training?
Yeah, gradual training.
Or gradual discourse.
Anupupikata. Anupupikata is in Pali, so it's like it's a graduated discourse. Let me take a look. I think I made a note not that long ago. Yeah, anupupikata. Constituent topics are dana, so generosity, and so that there, and which is always, it's always introduced before sila, even, because everybody can practice generosity, and sometimes not everybody can practice sila. And then the sila, virtue. And then the next is sangha, or heaven. So that there, in a sense, there are heavenly realms, heavenly states that are a result of skillful action, living in the world. It's not, how to say it, there. You're introducing the effects of the wholesome effects of skillful karma, so that the mind accepts that. Then adinawa, which is drawbacks of sense desire, of sensualities, of chasing after materialism, chasing after consumption, so the drawbacks of the world. Nekhamma is the benefits of relinquishment, the kind of the joy and brightness that comes from when we're able to let things go, let things drop. And then the Four Noble Truths. Yeah.
Yeah, the order of that list shows the Buddha's brilliance and compassion as a teacher.
Wow.
Because in each of those stages, he's going to lose some of his audience. Some people are just not able to go further. And so by doing that, by teaching in that order, he ends up benefiting everyone to the extent
That they're willing. I lived in Thailand for a long time, so the spectrum of people that you see coming to a monastery, and there's plenty that come. They've got faith in the triple gem. They practice generosity, but sealed is just way beyond them. You think, well, it shouldn't be that difficulty, but it is for many people, and so that the teachings are there to benefit everyone at whatever level they're willing to pick them up, and not everybody's going to be able to have that sense of renunciation and relinquishment. At each stage there's people, but it's also I've seen probably the most dramatic example was a gangster who came and he was suffering, and he started coming to this branch monastery of Ajahn Chah's, and of course the monk Omdrön knew the town and knew who this was and what his background was, and when he started showing interest in some kind of way to alleviate suffering, his first thought, this is beyond my pay grade, I better take him to Ajahn Chah. I took him to Ajahn Chah, and he was and Ajahn Chah was great. He had him stay underneath his kuti and attend to him. But the guy was, had a gang, and they controlled this. I mean, it was a fishing port, so it was a pretty rough place, and they had a tight control on everything, and so that killing people was not. It was just part of business. It was just Sila was definitely not on the foremost, but then after his time of living with Ajahn Chah, he came back and told his gang, from now on out, we're going to keep the five precepts. And the gang was sort of... this isn't going to fly. And then Ajahn Chah came, and I remember... came to visit, and the whole gang came to pay respects. So these are really rough characters, and asking questions, and Ajahn Chah sort of really. Remember one saying, "What do we do if people steal from us? We're kind of extorting and whatnot, but." That's fair game, but what do people steal from us? And Ajahn Chah didn't answer it. He said, what have you been doing? He said, usually we just cut off their hand. And Ajahn Chah, Angulimal only cut off fingers. So he really drew people in, and overall, he really tried to make a change. Although he also knew that over time, he'd be able to hold it together for a while. And he's put everything in order, in terms of his family and his life. And about a year or two, a year and a half later, I think, he was killed by a rival gang. But he figured that was a worthwhile. Just to keep the precepts rather than reverting back to the way. It's really interesting. But his gang members, the whole idea of CLO is a bit much. Okay, onward. Although Nibbana is the highest and most worthy goal for one practicing the Buddhist teachings, the thought of ever attaining the sublime nature of that goal can appear daunting. So, to show the point of access to that goal, it is often a useful exercise to contemplate the first level of realization, stream entry. This helps to provide a clearer sense of what needs to be done in the first stage of the practice, and to provide a reminder of the practice's positive and attainable fruits. Therefore, exploring the various facets and aspects of stream entry should be a fruitful endeavor, as there tends to be little talk about or discussion of this quote-unquote lowly attainment, which often lives in the shadow of complete realization, Nibbana or Arhanship. Particularly in a modern Western culture, inundated by advertising and the overstimulation of the consumption ethic, the mind can be constantly searching for anything with a superlative prefacing it. The ultimate, the perfect, the refined, the exquisite. If this is the case in our spiritual aspirations, we will tend to overlook the foundations when trying to reach the ultimate too quickly. This impatience can easily lead to frustration and a feeling that the goal is impossible to attain. So reflecting on stream entry can play a very important role, especially in that it allows us to see what can be incorporated into our daily lives and practice. A sotapanna is one who has reached the first stage of liberation, stream entry, sotapatti. The early commentators emphasized that the stream enterer had a first taste of Nibbana, and the motivation arising from that initial realization would, without a doubt, provide the impetus that would carry the aspirant on to the final goal. After one has realized stream entry, one's full awakening is assured in not more than 7 lifetimes. This is nothing to be looked down upon. Stream enterers will not be reborn in any of the lower realms. They will at least be born in the human realm or higher. This is a great blessing. The ultimate goal of the teachings is not a one-shot affair. Either you get it or you miss it completely and are forever out of luck. There is a progressive maturing of insight into the nature of the goal that leads the practitioner to relinquish the obstructions blocking realization and to fulfill the qualities commensurate with realization. A good example of this is the account of the Buddha teaching his first 5 disciples. With this teaching, Kondanya was able to understand and realize stream entry. Over the following days, the Buddha continued to instruct the 5 until they had all entered the stream. Then, later, on hearing the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the discourse on the characteristics of not-self, they were all fully freed. Although some people may be quicker than others in reaching the goal, the structure of the unfolding insight is common to all. The most familiar description of the stages of realization contains 4 levels: stream enterer, sotapanna, once returner, sakadagami, non-returner, anagami, and one fully enlightened, the arhan. These levels are differentiated according to the fetters, sangyojana, that a liberated person relinquishes at each stage. Is there any question before we go into, or comments before we go into detailing that? So this is from Samyutta 45, Sutta number 179. Because there are these five lower fetters, what five? Identity view, doubt, the distorted grasp of rules and vows, sensual desire, ill will. These are the five lower fetters. So identity view is sakkaya ditti, the kind of the identifying, like almost like an embodiment of the view of me embodied in this being. And that's always associated with the sense of formulating a sense of me and mine out of body, feeling, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness, one or all or a combination of any of them can be the base of that clinging. Doubt, a sort of skeptical doubt. distorted grasp of rules and vows is sila bhatta paramasa, sense of assumption that there is a purification by some kind of keeping some kind of rule or some kind of practice. Sometimes it's translated as, like an attachment to practice and precept is one. In early translations, it was rites and rituals that were how it was translated, but it's really around that sense of if I just kept this particular rule or I managed to keep this kind of practice, then that would be the key to my realization. So those are the three lower fetters that constitute the in entering into the stream. When those are relinquished, and then that doorway of the into the stream, into sort of bhakti is open. Sensual desire and ill will, say the once returner, attenuates sensual desire and ill will. There's a marked decrease, loosening, weakening of that pull to sensual. So like a stream enterer, in the Buddha's time and throughout Buddha's history, stream enterers living in the world and living household life, and it's not hugely uncommon. The relinquishing of sensual desire and ill will is the characteristic of the anagami, non-returner. The once returner would be returning to the human realm one more time before full realization. The non-returner would not return to the human form, but to go to the. There's a set of realms that are the higher realms and of the Brahma realms, and they'll sort of spend their time in that abode and then be shift into full awakening after. So those are the five lower fetters and 16. Because there are these five higher fetters, what five? And it's also from Samyutta 45, Sutta number 180. Because there are these five higher fetters, what five? Lust for form, lust for the formless, conceit, restlessness, ignorance. These are the five higher fetters. So lust for form is with rupa raka, and these are more meditative attainments. When you say lust for form, it's not sort of material form in the sense of sensual desire, sexual desire. It's desire for the bliss of the form, jhanas, first, second, third, and fourth jhanas are what are the rupa jhanas. So that there, it's a craving after for the meditative attainments. Lust for the formless is a craving after the, say, the fruits of the formless jhanas, the dropping the bone bend and dwelling in the mental realm. Conceit is asami mana, which is the asami is I am, and mana is conceit or assumption. So this is not the same as Sakkaya Ditti. Sakkaya Ditti is sort of identification of an embodiment in this embeddedness into mind and body. But the sense of the asamimana is a refined sense of I am. Because even in that sense of like awareness or me being the knower, me being the observer, the sense of feeling of me that's in there, and not recognized like a say a Ajahn Chah, it's just this much. these are recognizing something as a natural phenomena, as opposed to me, and it's quite it's very subtle. Which is why it's a higher fetter. Restlessness, is not the restlessness not being able to sit on one's cushion and having to find something to do. It's the restlessness of the mind seeking. Not quite content with this and looking for something else there. So there's a subtle restlessness in the mind that is relinquished it. And then ignorance, just the sense of a lack of penetrative knowledge of the true nature of things. Any questions? Yeah.
So, upon passing, when a bhikkhu or arhat passes, is there a process for that passing, or is it strictly according to the meditative attainments that one goes from one life to the next? Or is there some description of it in the suttas?
There is no description of it in the suttas. and that, of course, has led to, especially in terms of of an arahant or an awakened being, then it is a transition into full release, in that sense and that's where this whole aspect of nirodha, cessation, or non-manifesting, non-identifying with. The language is kind of you can come up to the door and you can't, language doesn't really get you through that, but in terms of the an ordinary person, then it would be the strength of the karmic force of the within the mind, taking one to a to a place of you know, whatever, peace, clarity.
So there's no advice to rest in meditation in the dying process?
There's no advice, but the Buddha is saying, I mean, that's what we should be doing all the time. Because you're basically, each moment should be a rehearsal of dying, really. And the Buddha is quite explicit with that, in that sense of the contemplation of dying is a momentary and because death can come at any time, and to be able to establish awareness and mindfulness even as one breathes in, breathes out, or that's the amount of time that you've got. Because either the Buddha said, for the time it takes to breathe in before you breathe out, your death can come in that time, or you can swallow away one mouthful of food, which is about what it takes for like a major aneurysm or a stroke. Yes.
So when you hear about the teachings that you've just been talking about, with the way that there are these different stages of enlightenment,
right?
With the fetters, so these fetters going at these stages.
Yeah.
And I remember when I first heard about it, well, it was kind of helpful, but at the same time, it seemed to make it. It was so sort of stratified with these kind
right.
of. You have to do it like this, and then, and it sounded so complicated and so kind of involved, and like whereas Paul would teach about it's here and now, it's right now, and that was so liberating.
Yeah,
and yet, so somewhere between this, like it is.
Well, it's also why we're sort of we're drawn to Lopa Sumedho's teachings or Lopa Cha's teachings, because it just make it very accessible and down to earth and practical.
Is there some way of sort of like, so you've got the immediacy of the teaching and the practice was really...
Well, I think one of the things, I think one is actually having a sense of what the parameters are, or what are the kind of indicators. Okay, this enlightenment is not going to carry this me into... Of me and my body and me and my emotions and thoughts and my brilliant ideas are not going to cut it. So that to that extent, then you start, and I think you're really getting the flavor of relinquishment and realizing that the buoyancy and brightness of the heart really comes from how much we're willing to let go rather than what we're trying to achieve or attain or measure, because that measuring it's another function of me.
So I think this teaching can be used in a way that's a bit misleading.
Yeah, which is why there's so many. This book sort of tries to sort of cover the practical elements. But also, we don't want to overlook the basic teachings that the Buddha and the kind of baselines that are it gives you some fences to sort of stay within.
I suppose that was my question. Was I'm not saying because the sort of thing that might sound like that. But I suppose what I meant was something that sounds like you hear it and you go, I'm not going to get to that stage, and how will I know if I have, and what about that veteran? I've let go of that one, but that one pops up again. And but how can you use this talk of the fetters and the different stages in a way that's helpful? I suppose that's the question.
Yeah. I mean, that's the exactly what the again why we're so informed by the practicalities of, say, like of the Thai Forest tradition, of Lopa Sumedho himself, because it brings it back to an experiential level. And we really, yeah, it's good to know these things, but it's not good to clog the mind up with too much detail sometimes. Yeah, Brenda.
I'm wondering if the Pali terms for anger and ill will are similar, because ill will sounds so more aggressive even than anger. It's like you're wishing harm on someone else. It seems to me, and you might think I'm wrong, that with anger you don't necessarily wish harm on someone else. It just arises and it's involved with Sakyaditi.
There are different terms. There are different terms. Goda is anger. Payabada is ill will. In terms of a hindrance in the five hindrances, payabada is what usually comes up. But I'm not a Pali scholar, so there's going to be many different terms that cover things.
And what you were just reading for Sotapanna, there's no ill will. Is that what I heard you say?
Yeah.
Sense desires are fairly neat.
For a Sotapanna? No, there's still ill will. Even for a Sakadagami, there's still ill will, but it's attenuated.
Ill will, not anger, but ill will.
These are terms that are, I wouldn't try to sort of find a loophole out of.
It seems that ill will is so much worse than anger.
Well, I mean, just that any intent within the mind that is formulated with a sense of aversion, aversion being aversive to, upset by. There's different gradients, but as long as the seed is still there, then it can manifest in many different ways. So it isn't sort of, oh, well, at least I'm not sort of wishing to murder anybody, but I guess it's okay to get really pissed off from time to time. it doesn't quite work that way. It's just the inclination of the mind to pick up that taking exception with and being upset by is buying into the sense of me right and them wrong, or the ill will can be directed toward oneself as well. We do that from time to time, so that sense of being, taking exception to, being averse to, being upset by, being irritated by. The English language has many words in Pali as I've seen in kind of lists of like of Abhidhamma, but I could only remember a couple of them, it's a human experience of getting upset and reverse and having ill will. But it probably manifests most strongly in sort of wishing harm, which is that avihingsa. Because those are two forms of wrong thought. That are having ill will towards, but then also wishing harm on. So those are, I mean, they're rooted in just that fundamental, like lobha, dosa, moha, those roots of what are called mula kilesa, the root defilements. So like dosa would be a root defilement, and then all of the ill will, irritation, aversion, vengefulness, harming would be coming out of that that stain of the mind of dosa.
Are there any suttas that say that a Sotapanna does not have anger and ill will?
I don't know. No, 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 no. I wouldn't think so, because it's very explicit. If they didn't have, they wouldn't be Sotapannas. If they were free from anger or ill will, then they would be anagamis. I mean, that's the distinguishing feature, is the, because these are really deeply rooted in the human experience. So that a Sotapanna would, obviously it's going to be attenuated to a tremendous amount. A lot is let go of through it's like the Buddha giving the image of he's in Rajgir, and Rajgir is surrounded by seven kind of mountains, and one of them is Waipula, and the Buddha takes his puts his finger in the dirt, and there's a pile of dirt on the end of his fingernail, which is bigger, this mound of dirt at the end of my finger, or that Waipula mountain over there? And of course the monks say, well, Waipula mountain is far bigger, and what's on the end of your finger is very little. And the Buddha says, in the same way, the amount of suffering that a Sotapanna has relinquished is the amount that is Mount Waipula, and the amount that's left is what's left on my fingernail. So that's a huge deal.
And he says specifically the amount of suffering.
The amount of suffering, yeah. Yeah, 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 no, it's a big deal. So the amount of habitual patterning and habitual reactivity and all of that's dropped away is really amazing. So, and that's why part of the reason I use if you get 100 spears in the morning, 100 spears in midday, 100 spears in the night, it's still worth it. If there were a real guarantee. Okay. Yes.
Since someone has lost attachment, the way you said Sakkaya Ditti.
I can't hear.
Because the Sotapanna is supposed to have finished Sakkaya Ditti.
Yes.
Could it be that even when you said the small amount of dust, that if they do any actions which involve those things, they don't carry any karma because they are not connected to the volition side of things? They would be like, being a little bit rude, maybe, but not.
Yeah, they might. There's certain habit patterns that are not going to be. Because that's the nature of the weight of karma, and certain character traits are going to manifest. But still, I mean, there's a real wisdom and willingness to let go and humility that is established. But there's still going to be in the time of the Buddha, there's this great sutta where you know, different monks are gravitate to receive teachings from Sariputta, receive teachings from Mahamoggallana, receive teachings from Ananda, receive teachings from about the Vinaya, and it's because of their character makeup. They're drawn in certain ways, and you know, sort of different personalities. And you know, you think of even in say in this common era, I've met many monks that are considered fully awake and enlightened, and they all have different personalities. It's just that carries through. I mean, they're inspiring in their own way, and they're manifesting differently, but yeah.
I was thinking in the Ratna Sutta, it says, even in secret, the stream actor does not break sila. So it means that.
There's certain bottom lines that.
Just a habit.
The habit of breaking sila is not.
The habit of what you said, the habitual tendency of it could happen, but they won't on purpose break sila.
Definitely. I mean, that's the thing. You wouldn't form a volition to break sila. Okay.